Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Agriculture Report and Science in the News, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome once again. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with a program that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today we have two stories for you. The first is about a growing influence that the Muslim religion is having on U.S. schools. Then, for something completely different, we go in search of the world's best-tasting coffee. As It Is starts now. As religious minorities increase in the United States, some want their public schools to close not only on Christmas, but also on their religious holidays. The issue is being debated in Montgomery County, Maryland, near Washington, D.C. It has become a difficult issue for local school boards, which set education policy in cities or towns. In the United States, public schools are under the control of local officials, not state or federal governments. Bob Doty explains.
In most U.S. public school districts, the number of religious minorities is small. But in Montgomery County, about 10% of students are Muslim. Musa Siddiqui is in the fourth grade. He says schools should be closed on the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice.
Whenever I have Eid on school days, I have to be dropped off of school. And then it goes on my report card, and I don't like how that goes.
Some Muslims also want schools to close on Eid al-Fitr at the end of Ramadan. At least six U.S. school districts already close on both Eid al-Adha and Eid al-Fitr. Zainab Chowdhury is a member of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. She welcomes the fact that school officials have given Muslim students permission to miss classes on religious holidays. But she thinks it is unfair for Muslim children to miss class when other children are in school.
Classes are still in session, so they still miss classroom instruction. Teachers will still teach. If there's exams that are going to be scheduled for that day, there will still be exams that students will miss out on if they decide to take off for school.
Montgomery County has some of the best schools in the United States. People from around the world live in the county. Local residents celebrate many different holidays. This year, Eid al-Adha will be celebrated at the same time as the Jewish holiday Yom Kippur. Schools in the county have been closed on Yom Kippur since the 1970s. Back then, school board officials found that 15% of the students and teachers were out of school on the holiday. Recently, parents of Muslim students attended a meeting of the Montgomery County Board of Education. Batya Steinloff is a Jewish religious leader and a member of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Washington. She supported the Muslim parents.
To communicate an appreciation of the rich diversity of Montgomery County.
But the board's chairman, Phil Kaufman, said a government agency should not recognize any religious holiday.
I don't think we should have any mention of specific religious holidays in our calendar because we are a public school.
All in favor.
The board voted to remove all of the names of religious holidays, including Christmas, from the official school schedule. However, schools will still be closed on those days. Saqib Ali is a parent and member of the Equality for Eid Coalition. He was not happy about the vote.
It seems like somebody's bending over backwards really, really hard to try and not give equality to the Muslim community.
He said many residents will reject the board's decision.
It's going to cause significant backlash in the wider community against the school board and against this administration.
Some people reacted to the decision on social media. They accused the school board and Muslims of opposing Christmas. Charles Haynes works at the Religious Freedom Center. He says the school board is in a difficult position.
Because the United States is now one of the most religiously diverse places in the world, and more religious minorities in the United States are speaking up and saying, we're here too. You've accommodated the Christians and the Jews on the calendar. What about us?
Mr. Haynes says if a religious group is large enough, it may be able to pressure a school to close because so many students will be absent on that faith's holiday.
But absent that argument, the school board may not do it without violating the First Amendment.
Among other things, the First Amendment to the United States Constitution requires a separation between religion and government. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio promised during his campaign last year to close schools in America's largest city for Eid. If he does, it may help Muslim parents in Montgomery County and other places. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. An international group of coffee experts has rated Ethiopia's coffee as the best in the world. Coffee is a top export for the country. But at home, it is a source of national pride. Ethiopians feel good about their coffee, and enjoying a drink with friends is a long-standing tradition. What makes Ethiopian coffee the best? Marcia James thinks she knows.
An international group of coffee experts has rated Ethiopia's coffee as the best in the world. Coffee is a top export for the country. But at home, it is a source of national pride. Ethiopians feel good about their coffee, and enjoying a drink with friends is a long-standing tradition. International coffee experts travel the world to find the best-tasting cup of coffee. They keep returning to Ethiopia. Some people say the climate produces quality beans. Morten Weiningard is a coffee importer.
You have different old ancient varietals referred to as Ethiopian heirloom. They are grown in places with perfect soil, perfect altitude, and microclimates that are really suitable for coffee processing, such as drying, things like that.
Finding the best quality beans is often an issue of taste. The intense process is known as cupping. Tasting and comparing coffee from different roasted beans, grading, and then pricing them. But before international experts come to taste, coffee beans are studied in small coffee laboratories. Helen Asafa, a lab technician, describes the process.
When the coffee comes to the lab, we assess the coffee quality first by recording the details. Then we weigh the moisture level and we screen the beans for analysis. After that, we grind the coffee beans and taste the samples. At the end, we check for defective bean.
Mubarak Abaoli is a lab worker. He says the testing is a very difficult and lengthy process.
We sort out the defect manually by hand, and we sort out the defect according to the defect types. The types are immature, pest damage, foxy, black. All has to be sorted out according to the severity of the defects.
Ethiopia is making big profits on its coffee reputation with exports to more than 120 countries. The country has an export revenue of more than $840 million a year. But not all the best coffee leaves Ethiopia. 40% of the coffee grown in the country stays there. It remains an important part of everyday life at work, at home, and at ceremonies just to celebrate that special cup. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
The Agriculture Report is next, followed by Science in the News. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Many science fiction stories tell about explorers arriving in a new world. The explorers then use some kind of high-tech device to test for breathable air or signs of life. But here on Earth, science fiction is becoming reality through a new sampling technology called environmental DNA, or eDNA for short. Scientists can use it to identify rare or invasive species, study biodiversity, or estimate fish populations with just a little air or water. Ryan Kelly is an ecologist at the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs at the University of Washington in Seattle. He works in a laboratory there with other researchers. They study the genetic material released by living creatures. Ryan Kelly says he and his research team are studying water samples collected from Puget Sound. He says the cost of gene sequencing has plummeted in recent years. That makes DNA testing more widely available. Environmental DNA can be used in two ways. One is to identify the creatures that live in a certain place. The other is to confirm the presence or lack of a specific creature. Karen Goldberg heads the new eDNA lab at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. She is one of the first biologists in the northwestern United States to take the technology from the testing phase to actually using it. Karen Goldberg sees eDNA as a way to get answers more efficiently, safely, and with less destruction compared to traditional survey techniques. Until recently, scientists depended on snorkeling, netting, or using an electric current to temporarily capture fish. This newer way to identify what lives in the environment is becoming popular around the world. Animal experts in Vietnam are using the eDNA to find the last wild Yangtze giant softshell turtles. One researcher on the Caribbean island of Trinidad is using the sampling technology to find endangered golden tree frogs. And in Madagascar, it is being used to identify amphibian diseases. Ms. Goldberg has used eDNA testing to confirm the local extinction, disappearance, of a leopard frog in the American state of Idaho. She has also been asked to document the spread of the New Zealand mud snail in the state of Washington. The creature has been found in lakes and other waterways across the state. Now, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management wants Karen Goldberg to look for the Columbia spotted frog in two other western states. The rare amphibian is a candidate for the federal government's threatened species list. Scientists working with the technology say they do not expect robots to replace field biologists anytime soon. But the old-fashioned fieldwork could soon be more targeted. A related research goal is to show how long environmental DNA can last and how far it can travel in different environments. And that's the Environment and Science Report from VOA Learning English. For more environment, science, and agriculture reports, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, this is Science in the News. I'm Mario Ritter. Today, Bob Doty and Pat Bodner provide a short guide to first aid.
Doctors in hospital emergency rooms often see accidental poisonings. A frightened parent arrives with a child who swallowed a cleaning liquid. Or perhaps the harmful substance is a medicine. Or it might be a product meant to kill insects. These are common causes of accidental poisoning. In cases like this, seek medical help as soon as possible. Save the container of whatever caused the poisoning. And look on the container for information about anything that stops the effects of the poison. Save anything expelled from the mouth of the victim. That way, doctors can examine it.
In the past, some people forced poisoning victims to empty the stomach. They used a liquid, syrup of ipecac, to do this. But a leading medical organization no longer advises parents to keep syrup of ipecac. The American Academy of Pediatrics says some poisons can cause additional damage when they come back up the throat.
Millions of people know how to give abdominal thrusts to save a person choking on something trapped in the throat. The American Red Cross says a rescuer should first hit the person on the back 5 times between the shoulder bones. These back blows may ease the choking. If the airway is still blocked, the Red Cross suggests pushing hard 5 times along the victim's abdomen. The abdomen is the area between the chest and the hip bones. You can do these abdominal thrusts by getting directly behind a sitting or standing person. Put your arms around the victim's waist. Close one hand to form a ball. Place it over the upper part of the stomach, below the ribs. Place the other hand on top. Then push forcefully inward and upward. Repeat the abdominal thrusts until the object is expelled from the mouth.
For someone in late pregnancy or who is very fat, place your hands higher than with normal abdominal thrusts. Place the hands at the base of the breastbone, just above the place where the lowest ribs join. Then begin pushing, as with other victims. The American Heart Association suggests another method in this case. The group advises chest thrusts instead of abdominal thrusts. For chest thrusts, put your arms under the victim's arms and your hands on the center of the victim's chest.
Even if you are the person choking, you can still help yourself. Place a closed hand over the middle of your abdomen, just above your waist. Take hold of that hand with your other hand. Find a hard surface, like a chair, and rest your body on it. Then push your closed hand in and up. Red Cross experts say taking these steps can save many lives. But they also say abdominal thrusts are not for people who have almost drowned. They say using the method could delay other ways to restart breathing in the victim.
CPR is cardiopulmonary resuscitation. It forces air into the lungs and pumps blood and oxygen to the brain. Doctors say CPR greatly increases the chances that a person whose heart stops will survive. It increases the chances that he or she will suffer little or no brain damage. The American Heart Association suggests two ways of helping. One combines the use of hands to pump the victim's chest with rescue breathing. The other method is called hands-only CPR.
Hands-only is for people who are unwilling or unable to perform rescue breathing. Some people fear infection. Others say they are afraid of making the patient worse. But an expert in emergency medicine says a person cannot be worse than dead. Dr. Michael Sayer works at Ohio State University. He strongly urges people in contact with a victim to take action.
The American Heart Association tells how to take that action. It says you can recognize a person needing CPR because the person has collapsed. He or she is unconscious, unable to communicate or react to surroundings or speech. His or her skin has lost color. The person is not breathing. If such conditions describe the situation, chances are the heart has stopped beating. You should act by calling for help or sending someone else. Even if you cannot do mouth-to-mouth rescue breathing, you can perform hands-only CPR. You can do chest compressions that help to keep blood flowing to the brain, heart, and other organs. To perform the compressions, place one hand over the other and press firmly on the center of the victim's chest. Push down about 5 centimeters. Aim for 100 compressions each minute. Dr. Sayer says you do not need a measuring stick or a timing device.
If the heart does not start beating, continue with chest compressions until help arrives. For a choking victim who is unconscious with no heartbeat, clear the airway first. Then do chest compressions. Dr. Sayer suggests that medical workers do both the breathing method and chest compressions. He says some victims, including babies, need the mouth-to-mouth breathing with the compressions. Still, the doctor says it is better to do just chest compressions than to do nothing. CPR is not difficult to learn. Many organizations teach it.
Most CPR training now includes how to use an automated external defibrillator, or AED. Defibrillators use electric shocks to correct abnormal heartbeats that can lead to sudden death. Such devices are found increasingly in public places like airports, restaurants, and office buildings. A recorded voice on the AED guides the user. The voice provides detailed information about what to do. The defibrillator of today has developed from the first defibrillators. Medical historians say the devices appeared late in the 19th century.
In the 1920s, American Claude Beck performed the first surgical operations to repair damaged hearts. Dr. Beck worked at what is now called Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine in Ohio. Another doctor, Carl J. Wiggers, had kept laboratory animals with heart stoppage alive by massaging their hearts. Then he followed this rubbing with electrical defibrillation. This led Claude Beck in his efforts to help return normal heart actions to human patients. In 1947, Dr. Beck saved a patient with a defibrillator device for the first time. The doctor's success led others to further develop the method and device. Today, small, movable AEDs can identify heart rhythms and produce electricity to treat victims of heart stoppage.
Bacteria can enter the body through even the smallest cut in the skin. So medical experts advise people to treat all wounds. Clean the cut with soap and water, then cover the wound while it heals. The Mayo Clinic health centers suggest several steps if bleeding is severe. First, if possible, have the person lie down and raise the legs. Remove dirt from the wound and press on it with a clean cloth or piece of clothing. If you cannot find anything clean, use your hand. Keep putting pressure on the wound until the bleeding stops or medical help arrives. Do not remove the cloth if the blood comes through it. Instead, put another cloth on top and continue pressure. If the bleeding does not stop with direct pressure, put pressure on the artery that carries blood to the wound.
In the past, people were advised to stop severe bleeding with a tourniquet. This device is made with a stick and a piece of cloth or a belt. But experts now say tourniquets are dangerous because they can crush blood passages and nerves. If a wound seems infected, let the victim rest. Physical activity can spread the infection. Treat the wound with a mixture of salt and water until medical help arrives. Add 9 1/2 milliliters of salt to each liter of boiled water. Place a clean cloth in the mixture, and then put the cloth on the wound. But be sure not to burn the skin.
To learn more about first aid, ask a hospital or organization like a Red Cross or Red Crescent Society for information. Training may be offered in your area. If you know first aid methods, you can be calmer and more helpful in case of emergency.
This Science in the News program was written by Geraldine Watson. Our producer was June Sims. I'm Mario Ritter. Listen again next week for more news about science on The Voice of America.